Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Is that the hardest prayer in Scripture? Welcome to Pro. We continue our series on Jesus' wondrous cross, the story of redemption, and our lesson topic for this week is Darkness at Noon, the Crucifixion Experience. My conversation partners are Paul Dibdall and Larry Vavirka. What we are going to do is just take a glimpse at Jesus' seven words on the cross as just a way into the experience. We may not get through all of them. We'll see what happens. But I'd like to start with that first one. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Is this prayer for forgiveness for his enemies the highest possible goal for a believer? Are there times when we should not pray that prayer about our enemies? What do you think?
That's a tough one, Alden. And of course, the silence preceding the response was an indication of how difficult that question is. The words of Jesus to pray for those who despitefully use us. The hard sayings of Jesus, to go the second mile, to not just give him your coat in addition. I mean, this seems to be very consistent with his teachings, and yet really, really a challenge.
Well, on our campus, we have all struggled through this with Daryl and Barbara Bigger. His daughter was raped and murdered. How in the world? You come to the place where you, from the bottom of your heart, can pray that prayer. Can you pray it at all? Can you pray it through clenched teeth? Is it an ideal, a goal, and life has to go on? Forgiveness is, after all, a gift of God.
Yeah.
And I worry that we may be crushed by our ideals and just shrug and not leave ourselves open for the continued work of the Lord. Boy, that's an amazing prayer.
Is it significant? You know, the request, this is a request, Father, forgive them. Might that be easier for a person to pray sometime instead of saying, I forgive you?
That's a good point.
To say, God, I can't.
You do.
But you do it.
That's intriguing.
And again, maybe I'm making something out of something that's not really there even. But I guess I don't see that as Jesus saying that, but I don't know. For us, I think that may be helpful sometimes. God, you've got to do it because I don't feel it within me.
Do we sometimes enjoy our hatred in the same way that, as my father, a physician, used to say, people enjoy poor health? Is there a sense in which we sometimes really don't want the Lord, you know, like Jonah, I have a right to be angry?
Yeah, no, I think we hang on to it. We get used to it. Mm-hmm. It's for some people, it's a force. You know, this resentment, this anger is provides almost a reason to live in some ways, ironically, even as it saps them of life. But I keep looking at Larry.
It's a kind of compensating power, yeah, in the face of powerlessness. I mean, I do have my anger, which gives me energy or, yeah, reason to continue drawing breath. At the same time, it seems to me that it's really important that we be angry enough at times to stop something that is happening that needs to happen. I don't know that we want the wicked to prosper in their wrongdoing. And the Psalms that confront this and say evil must stop or evil must be contained or evil is wrong and it's not to be supported or we're not to be doing things that perpetuate evil are also important instructions as well.
Well, Ephesians does say, be angry, but do not sin, and don't let the sun go down on your anger, which I think is really quite intriguing.
Yes.
Well, I think anger is a more, in many ways, a more comfortable emotion than hurt or pain. So when we've been wronged, I think we quickly, our hurt or our pain turns to anger in a sense as a sort of secondary emotion, because that's one that we can live with much more so than the, just the hurt or the pain.
Well, and it's where we find power to do something if we're going to do something. It's out of that, out of the anger. And that's why using one's anger constructively to do something positive or something to prevent the continuance of the wrong is a good avenue, good direction, a good goal, for example, to sense.
Let's move on to another one, and we'll have no way to deal with all seven of them here. Let's come down to, well, let's go into the second one. To the thief, Jesus said, "You will be with me in paradise." Deathbed conversion, apparently. Because this guy, according to at least one of the Gospels, both of these were reviling Jesus. And then all of a sudden he sees the light.
Yeah, 3 hours on the cross. If you look at the time frame there, 3 hours on the cross with Jesus, and makes a difference for one of them, apparently. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, death, the value of deathbed conversion, who can say? Who can judge? But certainly, the story of the thief on the cross lets us know that it is possible for someone at the very end to find acceptance and grace.
I suppose the greatest danger would be is, I'll wait till my deathbed.
Sure.
You may not have a chance.
Jesus kind of covered that in one of his stories, didn't he, when he talked about the you know, the rejoicing in heaven, the delight over any sinner who's saved, no matter where that person is in the stream of the day, it's the salvation is the same, whether you are working for the master all day or whether you come at the last minute and you work for the master, the compensation or the reward is the same. The difference is the privilege of having worked for the master. And the loss is of the one at the last minute having lived a life that's been, whatever, marginalized or difficult or challenging in ways that may not have been the case if there had been that sort of faithful life.
Mm-hmm. But the irony, even though I think that's a marvelous description of the way it should be, the irony both in that story where the workers have got all paid the same and the elder brother, that those who should have been rejoicing were actually angry at those who'd come in.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't appreciate the generosity.
Well, but still that happens today about this. I mean, we wouldn't be raising this issue of deathbed confessions if there weren't some, you know, tension or dismay that's still around in the community over whether or not these really are valid and whether or not, you know, God really recognizes these. But I think the story just supports that God will take us any time, any way, under any circumstance if we respond.
My guess is a crucial factor is here. A lot of people think that God is a wet blanket, and if you're going to follow him, life just isn't fun.
Yeah, I think it's a misunderstanding of what it means to live as a Christian if you feel like someone who came in at the last minute somehow had it better than you.
My God, why have you forsaken me? Let's go to that one. I find it intriguing to ask my students if they could pray that prayer, and many of them say they couldn't.
What do you mean? I don't understand that.
What I think is going on there, Paul, when students say they couldn't pray that prayer, that sounds so rude, so blasphemous, to tell God to his face, "You've forsaken me." Okay. And I think maybe they think, well, it's all right for Jesus to say this, but it's also an Old Testament one. And I think it's a terribly important prayer to be able to pray, because at least you get the dialogue started.
Yeah, it's a why question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not an agnostic question at all. It's one which knows that he's there.
But inaccessible somehow. connection is not present. Sense of his presence is not there.
Yeah. Now, there's one other aspect here, which, and I don't know how far we want to take this, but the traditional Christian interpretation that there had to be a separation between the Father and the Son, and that this God-forsakenness was an essential part of Jesus bearing our sins. Do either of you have any comment on that particular issue and what it might say about the nature of God's wrath?
Well, I don't.
I have an understanding of God's wrath against sin that starts in Gethsemane. And it's maybe it's a little too much projection, but I think of what it would be like for me to, by virtue of a choice that I made, where I had power to do something different, but by virtue of a choice that I've made, to have my hands tied and not be able to intervene or act on the behalf of my own child, flesh and blood family member, when I did have the power to do that, I would be incredibly frustrated. I would be incredibly angry, it seems to me, about whatever the circumstances are that are causing this experience. I see God's restraint, self-restraint, as being the locus of his anger against sin. He's not putting his thumb down and crushing out Jesus' life. That's Jesus' decision to take on the sin of the world, and that crushes out his life. And the Father stands by, in a sense, helpless. He's not helpless, but he chooses to let him experience the decision that he's made. And that self-restraint is the sense of just horrible frustration that sin is running its course this way, and he has to stand there and watch it happen.
So in a sense, we could say that God chooses, the Father chooses to be helpless.
Yes.
Yeah. And lets it just play out then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. One last one. Into your hands I commend my spirit.
You asked at the beginning, Father, forgive them. If this is the, what were your words about?
Is this the hardest prayer?
The hardest prayer. Yeah. I wonder if maybe in a sense, this might be the hardest prayer. Father, into your hands.
Yeah.
I commit my spirit, my life, it all is in your hands.
Yeah, it is his life, and it's his whole life. It's everything that he's done and said that's in God's hands.
Yeah. We'll have to pick up the pieces next time. Thank you, Paul, Larry. My thanks to Susan Michael, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.